Good morning. We all go home. Some go to Leamington, some go to Arnott, some go to Osler, some go to Abbotsford. We all go home. The great narratives of humankind all speak about home and return. Home is where everyone knows your name, where you can count on being confronted, listened to, and forgiven, where you tell your story, where there is always a place at the table, and where things on the table are being shared with you. The book of Joshua marks the end of the Exodus and speaks of homecoming. Israel enters the promised land under Joshua and a new generation of leaders. This morning's text rolls back the disgrace of Egypt, brings the people together, the manna stops falling, and the produce of Canaan is theirs to take. It's stunning to look over the Jordan Valley and imagine this story. For Hindus, there are some great stories as well. The Bhagavad Gita, also known as the Song of the Blessed Lord, is loved and known by all Hindus, the most referenced text for devotional and intellectual purposes. Amidst the prospering clan of the Pandavas, there is a faction consumed with jealousy, and Lord Krishna, God incarnate, rides into the clan conflict on his chariot and engages Arjuna, the Kaurava warrior, in an attempt to persuade him to take up the fight with his kinsmen. But Arjuna, the warrior, is hesitant. Life goes from my limbs and they sink, and my mouth is sore and dry. A trembling overcomes my body. I cannot see any glory if I kill my own kinsmen in the sacrifice of battle. Lord Krishna doesn't give up. He pushes him. Whence this lifeless dejection, Arjuna? In this hour of trial, he must fight. It is his dharma, his duty. It will preserve the order. The Gita thus embodies the great spiritual struggle of the human soul. The basic problem of humankind is our endemic refusal to live by a will other than our own. If you do not fight, you cannot return home. The Prophet Muhammad makes his Hajira, the flight to Medina from his home in Mecca, around 622 AD, and it's the beginning of 7 years of exile. But after the exile, he assembles a large army and returns to Mecca to consolidate his power, clarify the doctrine, and the details related to worship. Today, the sacred mosque and the Kaaba in Jeddah near Mecca remains the most sacred pilgrimage site for all Muslims. Indeed, once in a lifetime, a good Muslim must make the Hajj. Jesus, too, in his final weeks, made his way back to Jerusalem, the very center of Judaism, to challenge his own people to be in the world in a new way, to be the Jews they were. The great narratives of humankind all speak about home, about return from exile. The sailor comes home from the sea. The hunter comes home from the hill. The POWs come home from Vietnam. And they all have essentially the same struggle. How to settle back into the routine of home? It is not only how to sing the Lord's song in a strange land. It is about how to return from exile without being swallowed up by home. In October of 2015, Martha and I were walking the Cape Breton Trail when a clinical psychologist from Oregon walking with us reminded us that war is a force that gives us meaning. Young war veterans have survived, even thrived on high doses of adrenaline, which home can simply not provide. My mother was Russian Mennonite by birth and a touch aristocratic. Grandpa Born owned the big village store in Hague and the telephone exchange, and he was gentle, generous, and made a lot of loans. Mother married Dad, a farm laborer who loved both horses and the homestead in northern Saskatchewan. Dad's parents were from the Crimea in the former Soviet Union, and they were Lutheran. Dad was born in North Dakota and baptized as an infant before moving to Fairholm in northern Saskatchewan, where he met Mother. Mother was one of nine children, the only one to complete high school and normal school. She was in her first year of teaching when she met Dad. Dad built the fire in the log schoolhouse, and the rest is history. Mom told me with a twinkle in her eyes one day before she died, that during those days on the homestead, we danced a lot and we even smoked some. They married and attended the small MB church on the homestead where Mother taught Rudy Weeb and his siblings and Dad's many brothers and sisters. Rudy suggests in his book that the Lobies did not have an easy time cracking the Mennonite Brethren Church. But Rudy says Grandpa John Loby was generous with those he employed at his small sawmill. We visited the old log house, Rudy and my kids and others, and we found the remains of our family houses in the graves of my great uncle David and Rudy's sister Helen near the hole in the ground which had been the Mennonite Brethren Church. In 1947, my family moved to Oster, Saskatchewan, where Dad started a successful business. The old colony Mennonite folks had great respect for my father, and in that he encouraged many of them to shift from shipping cream only to milk. Dad had a trucking business that hauled milk. We grew up in Oster Mennonite Church, and Mother desperately wanted Dad in the church. And it was that desire that brought the deacon, Mr. Ben Buhler, and the minister, Jacob H. Pauls, to our house in Oster in 1952. Only nine, I listened to the conversation in German from the kitchen, and I remember it as clear today as then. Reverend Pauls finally asked Dad if he would agree to be rebaptized, and Dad responded, "Das kann ich nicht, I can't do that. Es werde meine Eltern nicht ehren, it wouldn't honor my parents." Those, without hesitation, the deacon, Mr. Buhler, responded, "Wir akzeptieren Sie, wo Sie sind, then we'll accept you as you are." Those few words made all the difference. The church was held in high regard in our home, and our evening dinner table was a place where events and challenges of the day were recounted. It was a place where you could get busted for having been smoking behind a town toilet. I loved visiting the homes of Grandma and Grandpa Loby and the Bournes in Hague, Saskatchewan. There was something enduring and permanent about the big white house in Cold Lake, about the fishing, and the Bourne place in Hague, Saskatchewan, across from Dr. Ham's office, was rather special too. These were our places. They secured us. I remember those homes, delightful, great food, fishing, laughter, and later illness, and then death. Martha's old colony family was another touchstone of home. Her kingpin mother was strong and gentle. Strong even when her daughter lay badly hurt after a traffic accident in 1962. She put her hand on my shoulder and she said in German, "Das kracht so seit Eichel wir." It's just like it always was. Sadly, Mother Siemens died 3 months before we returned home from our 3 years in a small and very remote village, 1,000 kilometers northeast of Kolkata. Martha birthed our first son in that village, and Mother Siemens wrote often in Gothic German of her great longing to see the new baby, to hold him. Robert Frost, a kind of Wendell Berry, tried his hand at being a teacher, a cobbler, a farmer, and a writer. And in his superb poem, The Death of the Hired Man, Frost captures the rich sense of ordinary life on a farm. The three persons in the poem are Warren, a hardworking, matter-of-fact farmer who is not unkind, but who does have a memory and does not suffer fools lightly. And there is Silas, the hired man, shiftless and proud, who leaves unexpectedly during haying time when Warren most needs his help, only to return destitute and broken. The third person is Mary, the sympathetic and sensitive wife. Mary drew Warren down to her. "Silas is back. Be kind to him," she said. "Warren," she said, "he has come home to die. You needn't be afraid. He'll leave you this time at haying." "Home," he mocked. "Yes. What else but home?" she responded. "It all depends on what you mean by home. Of course, he's nothing to us, any more than was the hound that came to us as a stranger, out of the woods, worn out on the trail. Home is the place where, when you have to go, they have to take you in." Warren returned, too soon, it seemed to her, slipped to her side, caught her hand, and waited. "Warren?" she questioned. "Dead," was all he answered. Rohinton Mistry, in his superb novel Family Matters, writes this about his dying and irritating father-in-law. Curious how if you knew a person long enough, he could elicit every kind of emotion from you, every possible reaction: envy, admiration, pity, irritation, fury, fondness, jealousy, love, disgust. But in the end, all human beings become candidates for compassion, for homecoming, all of us, without exception. And if we could recognize this from the beginning, what a savings in grief and pain and misery. That was the secret: remembering your dying time in order to keep the stupid and the ugly out of your living time. Asma Shaheen, a Palestinian friend now living in Amman, tells me that his father fled his home in the West Bank in 1947 and that he had the key in his pocket to the day that he died. He gave it to Asmi. A few weeks ago, Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israel is, quotes, not home to the Palestinians. We have no place for them. This morning's texts include a psalm which tells us that happy are those who are forgiven, to those whose spirit there is no deceit in. The epistle reminds us that with Christ as our reference point, we are a new creation to be ambassadors for Christ. There was a man who had two sons, one in a foreign country and the other behind a barricade of self-righteousness. The estrangement between the brothers, between the father and the son, seems not uncommon. While both brothers were selfish, the older brother's is less obvious. He asked for nothing, desired nothing, and enjoyed nothing. He likely saw himself as the model of unselfishness, and yet he himself appears to be the center of his every thought. His almost slavish servitude and obedience suggests that he was something of a mercenary. Look at how many years I have slaved for you. He puts a mean-spirited construction on his brother's conduct. Your son was extravagant. He devoured your property with prostitutes. While he was feeding the pigs, while I was feeding the pigs that brought him to his senses, it took the impetuous generosity of his father's welcome for him to realize what it meant to be his father's son. At home, he discovered what he had not sought in vain among the counterfeit pleasures of the far country. But the father refuses to take sides. Notwithstanding their shortcomings, he loves them both. His rebuke of the elder brother is gentle. It's gentle. This is your brother. We are left wondering whether the elder brother persisted in his jealous rage or whether he joined the festivities. Rembrandt's The Prodigal Son, currently displayed in the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg, brings home the power of this story. Painted just before his death in 1669, it is an astounding work of art, soft and delicate. A sandal lying on the floor. The ragged and dirty robe of the younger son contrasts with the father's ochre-tinged robe lined with gold. The young son almost bald and repulsive. The father's carefully placed hands on his son's shoulders, his head tilted slightly to the left. The older son, well-dressed, with a cane in hand, serene and stern. The painting suggests a profound and evocative homecoming. In an essay 32 years ago, Peter Erb wrote about presumption and despair on remaining Mennonite, on his homecoming. The shards which remain are only shards, separated from the whole and from their parts. To seek to become another is to avoid the fact of plurality. Trapped between presumption and despair, no mode of existence is experienced other than that of faith, hope, and love. Seeking to understand the mystery of its own existence refuses pessimism and develops its optimism in an ever firmer adherence to an imitation of the ironic center of its being, the body of Christ, broken for us. And that means, suggested Rod Sawatsky years ago, that we must first and foremost be gracious. Gracious people, Rod suggested, are a people rooted in a natural sense of gratitude and awe. Gracious people serve our neighbors with love and pleasure. They're people of welcome and embrace. Gracious people understand that before gracious Christianity is public, it must be intensely personal. Mother Siemens was without a doubt where Christ was. And Dad Siemens? Would he attend the crusade in the village was the question when the car drove up to him while he was pitching bundles. The evangelist got out of the car and asked him if he'd come to the crusade in Warman. Dad Zeta would have liked me. Probably wouldn't. Now, Varomni, why wouldn't you come? Dobrukvani, don't need it, he said. And finally, the evangelist popped the question, well, are you a Christian? And Dad Siemens answered, Thromo Minnoba, check with my neighbor. Can one return, indeed, embrace profound acceptance without having experienced intense pain? In her book, Blue Rodeo, Joanne Mapson suggests that what we believe is about much more than religion. The invitation is to believe in the infinite wisdom there is to balancing the ingredients of human life, in the necessity of grief and its partner, joy. In a time to heed the urge of recklessness and then to admit the need for restraint, of departure and return, in hello and goodbye, and sometimes, if you're lucky or very forgiving, hello again. Here we have an in Christ kind of posture. Return, in my experience, has more to do with forgiveness of self than most anything else. But how is it that return is so difficult? I have watched close up these past few years the joy of the folks from Syria and Eritrea as they've arrived in Canada. And I've also heard countless stories of their longing to return. What is it that animates this desire for home? Mr. Bozan, a government-assisted refugee from northwest Syria, Kurdish, had been in Canada for 10 days. He and his wife arrived at the airport in Ankara with their 5 children. But UNHCR allowed only dependent children under 18 to accompany them, and so they left their 2 sons, 19 and 21, behind. The sons phoned often, daily, and long, and they pleaded, they were angry, they felt abandoned. The father? He was beside himself. He wouldn't eat. He cried for 10 days straight. He grasped onto us without letting go. He wanted to go home. Does one ever leave home behind? On the other hand, is return possible if you never leave? I find it easy to succumb to the temptation to settle into safety as opposed to wandering. And what is safety anyway? Is Tennyson right when he suggests that only those who will risk going too far can possibly find out how far one can go? We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. What might it mean? And how does one move towards a posture of forgiveness and return home?